He's a chemist for the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's Environmental Response Team, or ERT. He's been performing trace gas analyses for over 34 years. He holds a chemistry degree from Grand Valley State University and a chemical engineering degree from the Missouri School of Science and Technology. For over three decades, Dave has been the lead for the advancement, development, and operation of the Trace Atmospheric Gas Analyzer, TAGA Mobile Laboratories, which are outfitted with direct sampling triple quadrupole mass spectrometer, loop injection gas chromatograph mass spec, and micro GC instrumentation. I'm really proud of myself for not messing those up. He has extensive experience in monitoring, sampling, and analyzing outdoor ambient air, indoor air, and soil gas matrices. We recently got a tour of one of the TAGA mobile labs and thought that this would make a great online presentation, which is what prompted us to invite Dave to give this presentation today. So I just want to remind everyone, use that Q&A pod down in the lower right corner. And you all are on mute for the presentation. And Dave, if you're all ready, we'll go ahead and get you started.
Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to present today. And my talk today is going to be on the topic of vapor intrusion. Vapor intrusion guidance has been around for quite a while now. EPA's had draft guidance out in 2002, and its final guidance came out in 2015, I believe. The Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council had their guidance out in 2007, and DOD has a VI handbook through their Tri-Service Environmental Risk Assessment Work Group since 2009. And about 43 states also have vapor intrusion guidance, too. But today I'm going to talk about how we use the mobile laboratories to assist with vapor intrusion investigations. The former EPA Administrator Gina McCarthy signed the rulemaking to add a subsurface component to the hazardous ranking system on December 7th, 2016. This HRS was revised to include the subsurface intrusion component, and the rule was published in the Federal Register on January 9th, 2017. This action took effect on May 22nd, 2017. So now it has, a lot more relevance than it did previously, because it's actually used to put sites onto the Superfund listings. So I'm going to talk about the TAGA Mobile Laboratories, and we actually have three different laboratories that are self-contained. We have the truck that's on the top, as well as two buses that are on the lower left, and we do have a transport system, a truck and a trailer, for taking the instrument out to use indoors. The laboratories are actually located in Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, Edison, New Jersey, and Las Vegas, Nevada. This is a shot of the one of the TAGA mass specs, and this is the instrument that we use to monitor inside of locations and buildings and residences. As you can see in this particular picture, we are connected to the front end of the instrument using a Teflon tube. We pull air from inside the residence at about 90 liters per minute, and then a small representative sample is actually drawn into the mass spectrometer where it is analyzed. And this particular instrument is good for many of the priority pollutants of concern. So this is actually a animation for the TAGA work. So once the sample is brought into the source, it can be ionized. Once it's ionized, it can be separated out by electrical and magnetic fields. So in the first quadrupole, we separate out what we call the parent mass. So if you were to think of TCE, when all the chlorines are 35, because chlorine can exist as chlorine 35 or an isotope chlorine 37, which means that it weighs two more atomic mass units than the chlorine 35 does. And it exists in nature in a 3-to-1 ratio. So we set the first quadrupole to only allow chlorines that are all with chlorine 35. It weigh 130. So the first quadrupole is set to only allow the molecules that weigh 130 to enter into a reaction chamber, into the second chamber of this instrument. Here it's hit with a nitrogen gas and it causes fragments. But these molecules, or these ions in this case, are not fragmented randomly. They're fragmented in the manner that can best stabilize the charge, and that'd be losing one of the chlorines. So on the third filter, the third quadrupole, we look for 130 minus 35, so that would give you 95. So it filters out anything that does not weigh 95 in this third filter. And we allow that 130, 95 to strike the multiplier for 100 milliseconds. And then we continue the operation. We take advantage of the chlorine having that isotope, so we set it for 132. Loss of a 35 would give you 97, and we look at that parent-daughter ion pair. We also then look at the 132, loss of a chlorine 37, which would be 95, and look at 132, 95, and we just continually cycle through those ions as we go through the location. And the advantage of looking at multiple ions is that we went into one location recently, and you can see that we are looking for the three ions they discussed, the 132, 95, the 130, 95, and the 132, 97. And notice that two of the ions rise and fall very nicely together. And you would suspect that to be this particular compound. But the ion that is colored with the blue, the 132-97, does not rise. So unless they all rise and fall together, and if we've calibrated coincidental, like that correctly, they should be coincidental with one another, like on the spike at the very end after minute 55, it is not that particular compound. So what we were monitoring throughout the house is not TCE. And that's better represented with this particular profile where we're looking at each of the ions individually. And then at the end where we spike the instrument to demonstrate that it's functioning properly, we see all three ions rise and fall together. In the laboratory, we also have a GCMS, but we use a loop injection system, and we collect our samples in Tedlar bags, and this allows us a number of different advantages. If you've ever run these samples and you have a contaminated sample and you run it on a trap, you will contaminate the trap and you cannot use your GCMS until that trap is clean. When you use a loop injection system, you're only putting on a 5 mL sample instead of a 500 mil to 1,000 mil sample that you would put on a trap, and you're analyzing that sample. The disadvantages in many cases is that we cannot go down as low as laboratories that actually put on a larger volume size. However, we do have a detection limit of 500 parts per trillion, and by using this method, we have a dynamic range out to 10 parts per million. This is an advantage over a laboratory where when you inject the sample, you are going to only be able to calibrate out to approximately 20 parts per billion. That means if you run into a sample that is at 10 parts per million, you're going to have to dilute it 1,000 times down. That means that the sample is going to be, you know, like laid onto the column or injected onto the column with a much smaller volume, and there's a bigger chance of error. The way that this system works is that on the load position, we're going to load an internal standard, you know, like that on these two ports, which is actually on this port, which is actually a loop that's 50 microliters, and then we're going to load the sample on this loop between these two ports that's actually 5 milliliters. When we inject it, we introduce the carrier, and it goes through the internal standard loop onto the sample loop onto the column, and we continually flush that out until the run is completed. Because we're looking at for only compounds out to, perchloroethylene or tetrachloroethene, that means that we can have an abbreviated run, because we also use CO2 as our cryocoolant for our oven. We can actually have a run that goes from vinyl chloride out to PCE in less than 8 minutes. So it has a large advantage of looking at these compounds on Summa canisters, where you have to send it off to the laboratory and you have to assume that your samples are collected correctly. Otherwise, you have to remobilize to collect them again. You'll have this information very quickly. One of the additional advantages for this system is that we invite the residents or the occupants of the building onto the vehicle, and they can actually see the monitoring being conducted. This provides a number of advantages to us. Number one, we get to communicate to the person what is actually happening and explain to them in terms that they'll understand as they're seeing the monitoring proceed. And also it gives them an opportunity to ask us further questions, so it increases the communications as well as the transparency of all the operations. As far as vapor intrusions, there's a number of reasons that we're monitoring this, but the main reason is for health concerns. Now, I'm not a risk assessor or a toxicologist, so if I say something that is not exactly correct, you know, like that, you can correct me later. But if you assume that you drink 2 liters of water a day, and there's an MCL, a maximum contaminant level of 5 parts per billion, which translates into 5 micrograms per liter, your daily impact would be 10 micrograms per day. If you breathe air in a building like that, you breathe about 20 cubic meters of air a day. For TCE, if you take it for 1 part per billion by volume and put it into mass per volume ratio, it is actually equal to about 5.4 micrograms per cubic meter. So your daily impact would be 108 micrograms per day. One other part that you need to understand is that when it goes into your, when you ingest something, that it's going to be transferred, from what I understand, about 30% into the bloodstream. So your 10 micrograms per day is now down to about 3 micrograms per day. When you breathe it, it goes into your blood system at about 90%. So roughly at 110 micrograms per day or 108, you would be actually impacting your body with about 100 micrograms per day. So as you can see, it's about 33 times as much as you would get if you were just drinking the water. So line of evidence, when we do the vapor intrusion, there's groundwater, there's potable water, there's soil gas, there's ambient air, inside air, crawl space, building construction, and constituent ratios that you all consider for lines of evidence. As far as the groundwater, there's a number of different ways to collect groundwater samples. I'm not a geologist or a hydrogeologist, so I'll defer to those folks to tell you the best way to collect those types of samples. When you get into the air, though, there's a number of different ways that you can collect samples. Up in the upper hand, left-hand side is a lung box with Tedlar bags. You can collect samples in Tedlar bags. You can use sorbent tubes, or you can use Summa canisters. You can also use impingers. And I'm sure that there are other techniques like glass samplers that you can use that I haven't shown you. There's different ways that you can analyze these samples depending on the method that you collected them and the analytical method that you need to use to analyze them. I will simply talk about the instruments that we use on the TAGA, which are the triple quadrupole, the GCMS, and also the permanent gas analyzer. Now, the permanent gas analyzer only analyzes oxygen, nitrogen, CO, CO2, and methane. So there isn't as much of a call for that unless you happen to be adjacent to, say, a landfill where you may have off-site migration of CO2 and methane because it's pressurized. As far as, you know, like the different types of ambient air monitoring that we do the ambient air, the crawl spaces, and the indoor, and we can operate this system either stationary using the hose or without the hose, or we can drive the system around and monitor a wide area. Building construction, people that are familiar with vapor intrusion studies realize that no two homes are the same. The home up here in the upper right-hand corner is from the historic area of Dover, Delaware on the green, and the basement is down here in the lower left-hand corner. So they change, or the construction differs considerably from very finished out to dirt basements. How they're maintained is another issue, and the center the middle bottom, you can see that some are more cleaned up than others. So the construction is very different. So is the way they maintain them. We've been involved with a number of vapor intrusion sites across the country and every one of the regions, and every one of them is completely different. And the TAGA monitoring has been used at a number of these, as well as the GCMS. So the way that we would use this is that we have a 300-foot tube, and you can see that there's a fellow in the upper left-hand corner. He's holding the hose there in the distal end of the hose, and the proximal end of the hose is connected to the MSMS system. After we collect a two-minute outdoor, the sampler will go inside the residence and take a one-minute sample in each one of the locations. If there happens to be a point of concern, like a grate down here in the lower left-hand corner, you take the hose and you bring it down towards the grate and you hold it there for about a minute, and we'll get readings through there. It takes the sample about 30 seconds to through the 300-foot of Teflon tubing. We also look at ports and other drains and cracks in the floor as well. So the points that I'll discuss today are listed here, and I won't go through everything, but there's a number of, we're going to look at vapor intrusion sites that actually have that and other confounding factors that you should be aware of, that if you're not, they can give you information that you will assume that might suggest that you have a vapor intrusion problem, but you don't. So impacts due to vapor intrusion sources. This was a residence in New York at a TCE site. This site had contaminated groundwater with both TCE and 111 trichloroethane. This is going to be a quick animation, and I'll speed it up, but the circles that you'll see on this are going to represent 1 minute that we spend in each of the rooms. So we start with the outside, and we collect an outside sample. Then we go into each of the rooms, and as you can see, on most houses that are open construction and there are no sources, that the concentration from vapor intrusion will be equally distributed. Even down in the basement, as we go from room to room, there's not very much as far as an increase until we find a source. This is a closet where the infrastructure comes into the home, the water, the gas, natural gas, those types of piping are in the different locations. And we continued going through the rest of the home, and then we went out to the garage. And as you can see in the garage, it drops off pretty much the background. And this is because garages are well ventilated. But as we go back into the home and we go back closer to the wall, you can see the concentrations for the two compounds that were found in the groundwater are rising at about the same proportion that they were observed in the rest of the home. As we finish this home, we go back outside and we do a spike to demonstrate that the instrument is functioning properly. One of the things I want to point out here is that we looked at this entire home. We collected, you know, that hundreds if not thousands of data points, and we did this in less than 35 minutes. So you're getting your data intensive, you're getting high density rapid time period. Now this is one that had lifestyle issues to it as well. This actually happens to be at the same site, same TCE, 111 TCA site in New York. And I'll speed this one up as well. So as we go through the home, notice both again, the TCE and the 111 TCA rises up. So as we finish up the upstairs, we go to the garage. Notice that the TCE goes up. The 111 TCA does not go up. It actually goes down. So we don't happen to have vapor intrusion here. We have another source. As we go back in and we go down into the basement, notice that the TCE and the 111 TCA rises together again. So as we finish up this particular run, we'll go back outside, we'll do our spike again, and then we go to do an investigation of what was being discovered in the garage. So we're going to go into the garage. And notice that the scale on the TCE, because we have auto scaling, and I couldn't do anything with this other than, you know, just put the higher scale. We go in front of places that have materials, and you can see that they rise. If there's nothing else that you get out of this, is that there is no such thing as a sealed container, that every container leaks. Is just a matter of degree. These were spray cans of starting fluid and silicon lubricant, and they used TCE as a mobilizer for themselves, or as a component to either degrease or clean off materials. So as we finish up this, we go back outside, and again we spike the instrument, which demonstrates that everything is functioning correctly. Outside ambient air impacts, you know, like that a lot of times we're involved with sites that are near other sources, or they could be the source themselves, but they don't, we assume that it's going to be vapor intrusion. This is actually a site in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and this is an apartment building here, and it has an apartment on the left side, right side, the upstairs. It also has a full basement. This building in the back is a dry cleaner, and it is the source that of what we believe was going to be the vapor intrusion, because they used to take the materials out back and dump them on the ground back in the 60s and the 70s. What we did see when we did this, and here's another animation, is that the outside, as we got close to it, you can see that the before we actually entered it, we were getting 15 parts per billion of perchloroethylene or tetrachloroethylene, and a slight increase in the TCE. As we go through the apartment that's away from the dry cleaner, you can see that the concentrations are fairly constant in this location, but at about 10 parts per billion. We go into the basement, and we see that it rises up. That actual blip there, where you see it go red up here in the top, is actually taking the hose outside. We saw 50 parts per billion outside. As we finish up the basement, you can see that it's higher than it is in the upstairs of the complex. You would assume with no further data that it's vapor intrusion. But as we take the hose outside, we get 80 parts per billion out in the ambient air. Notice this apartment over here actually has higher concentrations of PCE than in the basement. So therefore, it's not vapor intrusion. And that's one of the things that this provides you as well, this rapid analysis. This, we looked at three different locations, the apartment away from it, the downstairs in the basement, and the apartment that's closest, and it was less than 25 minutes for this analysis. This last business is the spike of the instrument to demonstrate that it's actually functioning properly. So the dry cleaner is right here, right by J. The winds were blowing at 050, so they're coming across here. So where we should see this is in this particular area. We decided that we would mobile monitor around here so we could determine if there was any type of other source that was upwind that we were not aware of, and that this is the sole source, and we are going to, you know, like that, address it that way. As you can see, when we're stationary right here between A and B, we're seeing the peaks rise and fall as the wind blows back and forth and it gets channeled down the street. As we drive through these different areas, these areas are marked with letters, as well as the letters on the top of the graph here, we are not seeing anything until we get to between E and F, and that's really right here. And then we see it rise up again. So we've now isolated our source, and that took less than 15 minutes. So this provides you a good way of isolating sources very quickly and giving you an awful lot of information. So if you were to take the whole graph that we did, you know, like that we showed you with the animation, this would be it for the trichloroethylene. This would be for the tetrachloroethylene. This is when the winds were blowing, you know, like right at the residence. They were blowing from the northeast at about 13 miles an hour. Assuming that the same operations are being conducted, when you're slightly off wind, notice that the TCE drops below this line right here, which is our quantitation line, and instead of being about 90 parts per billion, it's about 8 parts or 7 parts per billion. So it drops off dramatically. Another situation that you might run into is when you do vapor intrusion that is part of an attached facility. Knowing your neighbors is really important. We're going to investigate this building right here, which is the Department of Transportation, but across the street is a Superfund site. This is actually down in Region 6 outside of Little Rock. So when we did our monitoring here, we go into the facility, and we had already put in ports, and we didn't see anything in the ports. But notice that the PCE, tetrachloroethylene, and the xylenes are rising way above baseline. And those were two of the components that were in the groundwater across the street at the Superfund site. Notice that it does go down a little bit, and that's because we are keeping the doors open, you know, like that slightly, and you're getting air exchange into them. So where is this coming from? Well, let's investigate the neighbor next door. And when we did this, we go inside there, and you notice that it's much higher than it was next door. It's about 50 parts per billion. The previous runs were down in the 30s. So both of these compounds are associated with the operations going on in the police department, which happened to be cleaning their gun cleaning station. So this particular facility, the police department, was actually adversely impacting the Department of Transportation. Impacts due to contaminated well water. We did a site in Region 3 in Pennsylvania, and Pennsylvania has a different MLC, the maximum contamination level, or MCL rather, for hazardous materials than what the federal EPA has. So they don't put on a groundwater system until about 30 parts per billion in the water. So one of the things that I wanted to bring out with this is that we actually did an experiment inside this home. What we did was we turned on the showers in this room and in this room, and we let them run, and then we looked at the concentrations as a function of time. Again, the circles represent 1 minute in each of the rooms. So we go into the facility, and we have the water running, and we really don't see much over the background. But as we get closer to the bathrooms, it starts to rise up. Notice that it's about 5 parts per billion for TCE. To get it in micrograms per cubic meter, you have to multiply that about 5.4. As we make our next run through there, the bathrooms are still, the showers are still going. Notice that it's up to about 15 in one and about 10 in the other. And that could be the difference between the temperature in the water, the shower head, the flow rate, the bathtub, anything that has an interface between the water and the ambient air. And the third time that we go through there, it's all the way up to about 22, 23 parts per billion, and the other room is up to about 16 parts per billion. One of the things I wanted to point out is that this is now the background for the entire house. It's up over a couple of parts per billion. And the interesting part about this is that when you open up these doors now, these rooms that have this contribution will be, you know, like that, filling up the rest of the home until there's enough air exchanges where it drops it down to, you know, like ambient air concentrations. So anyways, that was an interesting point to consider, because if you have a potable water situation going on and you don't know it and you're taking samples in the home, you may get a rise above background even though you've taken out all of the household materials. And if you put in a remediation system like if you did in the room that are in a home that had the household materials, it would be ineffective as far as controlling vapor emissions into the home that are due to the household situation or due to the potable water being used inside there. This home needs a POET system, a point of entry water treatment system. Crawl spaces, you know, like that, crawl spaces are interesting because many times they're very well ventilated, and you would assume that you would not get very much vapor intrusion into the home from them, particularly if the ventilation between them is considerable. Some of these homes you can enter in through the indoor of the house or from the outdoor of the house. When you do this type of work, especially down in Region 6, you may be greeted by critters that you don't want to get to know too personally. So that's why we use a pole to place the hose in there or also put a Suma canister in there. You don't want to get bitten. So when we did this work, we actually did monitoring inside this particular home, and notice that we get about 6 parts per billion inside this home. So if it's coming from the crawl space or from vapor intrusion from subsurface vapor intrusion, when we go into the crawl space, we should see a rise in the concentrations, and that's exactly what we see. So this was a very good way to prove that the crawl space was actually the source that we're seeing, because we did not see the concentrations in the ambient air beforehand when we went to do our monitoring or afterwards, but we do see it in the crawl space. So how well do these actually turn out to be with Suma canisters? This is a graph between the crawl space Suma canisters that were 24 hours and the TAGA 1-minute monitoring. Suma canisters and parts per billion by volume is plotted on the y-axis. TAGA TCE 1-minute measurements is plotted on the x-axis. For these particular homes, for this particular time, it seems to demonstrate a pretty good correlation. There are differences, but then again, you have to understand that we are collecting them for different periods. We're actually using different instruments, which means that we have different calibration systems, or calibration gases. And if you look at the calibrations, you're allowed to be plus or minus 30%. So this could be the difference just between basically one instrument being plus 30% on your calibration versus minus 30% on your calibration. So to me, it shows good comparison. Meteorological effects. This could, I may have wanted to also say this is also the effects of wet sump areas versus dry sump areas. This is actually a site in Region 3. And it was a TCE site. This site also had other chlorinated compounds that were associated with it all the way down to vinyl chloride. So we had a rainfall of about 1 inch the day before, and the winds were about 5 miles an hour. And whether the ground having been saturated or other situations, or it happened to be, higher water table, we actually saw about 120 parts per billion inside the home in the sump, So this is a lot higher than when we did the same home about a week later, where they even had, more rain, but higher winds, but the sump was dry, and we are getting about a spike of about 21 parts per billion in the sumps. So vapor intrusion from this is not really vapor intrusion by where you can say, okay, I have an attenuation factor due to a slab. This is going between the interface of water and air, much different. Signature compounds a lot of times, you know, like that early on, we looked at components that were observed in one location and components that were observed in another location and saying that they were from the same source. And that's a very good way of doing it. There's a there's a Superfund site across this highway. This is a gymnastics area that small children go to for training. And there's a home right here that's across the parking lot. When we went in here, and I'm sorry for the smallness of print, but this is actually three compounds. This is dichloroethene, all three of them, the 1,1 DCE, the trans 1,2 DCE, and the cis 1,2 DCE, as well as the 1,1 trichloroethane and TCE. Notice that they rise and fall together as you move the hose through the gym. When we go into the home next door, we always start outside, then do the upstairs, and then do the basement. Notice that they're lower upstairs, higher downstairs, so that means that your source has to be downstairs because of the concentration gradient, and they rise and fall together just like at the gymnasium. And that is due to the fact that they're from the same source. Self-polluting operations. This was the Camp Lejeune, and this is a school that was actually there. This was the Tarawa Terrace School, you know. And across the street here was a cleaners. Now they used PCE, and that was the ABC 1 hour cleaners, and this is the school. When we did the monitoring through the school, we didn't see very much, but we went down here into the boiler room, and sometimes it's better to be lucky than it is to be good, because they were actually cleaning the boiler switches. Notice that when we did the monitoring in this particular room, when we go to the sumps, we're actually seeing rises in TCE, not PCE. That means that it's not from the dry cleaners, which would have maybe some TCE as breakdown products, but this is exclusively TCE. What they were cleaning the boiler switches with was TCE, and the way that we verified that is we took the can, sprayed it onto a tissue, and waved it in front of the instrument, and we got a rise of just TCE, no PCE. And when they got done cleaning the switches, they would rinse it off, and that would drain down into the sumps. So this is an example of self-polluting without realizing it. Another one of the things that you need to take into consideration is what kind of operations were performed in the areas that you're going to be looking at. Accidental or intentional releases is another thing that you need to concern yourself with. We had a gasoline spill in Pennsylvania. And this particular home, we went into it and we monitored it three times. The first two times, and unfortunately you can't see this probably as well, but I don't know if there's a way to actually zoom in on this. You can see that the benzene is less than one part per billion on this time. The second time, it's less than one part per billion. And the third time, it's suspiciously above 900. Notice that for the other components, that it's less than four for the first two for the toluene. This is at 5,000 parts per billion. Similarly, for this one, you're at about four parts per billion for the xylenes and the ethyl benzene, and you're at almost 2,000 on this one. So this can be one of the situations where you have somebody enhancing their data or just happen to spill it into the one drain in the basement. So, you know, like that, be aware, be observant of if it doesn't seem to make sense, it probably doesn't. Next one I want to talk to you about is monitoring fractured bedrock. Everybody's, you know, like that in their guidance, you know, like that starts off with, you know, like that 100 feet away from your potential site. That maybe works well if you happen to have, you know, like a sandy area or, you know, like a non-consolidated area. But if you have, or a consolidated area, but if you happen to have fractured bedrock, all bets are off. This is another site in Region 3, and this injection well where they took all the contamination and they thought they would, you know, like that, put it into this well was almost 4,000, or this is 3,585 feet away from the impacted area as the crow flies. And this is the home. It's a beautiful, you know, like post-revolutionary home, but as you can see, when we did the monitoring in the basement, that we got as high as almost 350 parts per billion of TCE in this area. The PCE was about 10. There was also artesian wells at this site that at 25 degrees F, we were outside, and I was getting 25 parts per billion of TCE coming off that water. So there was considerable contamination that was flowing downstream. Another site, this one happens to be in western North Carolina, and you can't actually make this stuff up. They actually put this site on a saddle point. So this road rises and falls this way, and the mountains comes down this way. You couldn't pick a site to put contamination on any worse. So it's on this particular saddle point, and it goes down into the groundwater that then comes up to the surface water. So as we were mobile monitoring, we would see the groundwater, you know, like express itself in the surface water at this particular location as we drove past it. So at E and F, as we drove this way at E and F, we get this spike over here at about 13 parts per billion. As we went down the road further to G, where the creek then comes down here, we see it also in the groundwater at about 2 parts per billion. When we came back this way at H, when we go back over where we saw it at F, we actually see it at 20 parts per billion. Oh yeah, there's a school bus stop right here for the kids. As you go over the saddle point and come down this way and we go into a newly developed condo area, you also are seeing it at, you know, like J at about three parts per billion for the TCE. This site has gained a lot of attention for Region 4. Contamination of from utilizing contaminated groundwater also. This is actually at the Nebraska Ordnance Plant in Region 7. This was an Army facility that they had released material onto the surface, and it had gotten into the groundwater. Well, the university and all their farmers used this for cropland. So as we drove out of this facility, went down the road, and the wind's blowing in this direction to the northeast. The wind is from the southwest. The closest we could get is about 1,000 meters to there. Excuse me, 1,000 feet. And even though that this is very low levels, it's going to be in the high parts per billion once you get closer to the irrigation. These really aren't sprinklers in the sense that you use for a lawn sprinkler. They're huge irrigation sprinklers. So So this is one way the material can be released, and if you happen to have receptors nearby, then you have another pathway for your subsurface to get into people's homes through the outdoor air. All right, analysis when we use the TAGA MSMS system versus 24-hour samples indoor. If you have the home, this is an old slide. It's from, I think, 2004. We compared Summa canisters that were 24-hour to TAGA readings, both in part per billion, Summa on the y-axis, TAGA on the x-axis, and we see some pretty good comparability. If the houses are contained, so you don't have huge air exchange rates, we've seen that our data shows up, you know, like that, similar to what you would get out of a Summa canister. But I know that risk assessors like longer-term sampling, but this may prove to be something that would be of consequence for the practitioner to also have this data. So anyways, there are other websites. There's some information about the TAGA on this particular website. And there's an older version or older video that's also on the lower website. So if you'd like to have additional information. As far as coordinates, or if you wanted to discuss anything further, please take down the number or send me an email. I'd be more than happy to speak to you about any concerns that you have. And that concludes my talk. If there are any questions, I'd be more than happy to answer anything that you have.
That's great, because we do have a few lined up for you, Dave. First off, someone asked about if the machine can analyze for naphthalene and benzene. I know you showed a benzene example in there. Did you have some other analytes that you typically run on this?
Yes, we actually have done both. We're preparing to do a site in New York, or excuse me, in New Jersey, with Region 2. And I had never really paid much attention to naphthalene because it's basically almost a semi-volatile. But we have very good detection limits for naphthalene, so yes, we can look at both of those. One thing I do want to also mention, and I forgot, is that the GCMS is NELAP accredited for about 15 compounds using Tedlar bags and the loop injection. The TAGA is also NELAP accredited for two compounds, the TCE and the PCE, but we usually use it in the screening mode for that particular operation. I'm sorry. Yep.
Okay. Good to know. Thank you. Next question. Was that a HAPSITE unit that you showed back in slide 18? Is that a piece of equipment that you guys use?
Let me pop out of this for just a second. I'll move back. No, it wasn't. We do not use the HAPSITE. We have an Agilent that we use because it's very stable, and we've had great success with it. On slide 18, I don't have. Was it 18 or 8?
They text 18, but I'm not sure. We'll see if they post another clarifying question. We'll come back to that one. But you said that it is not a HAPSITE unit that you use typically.
No, we do not use the HAPSITE.
Okay. How about the Frog 5000 by Defiant Tech? Do you have experience using that unit?
We do not use that because what we have is we have definitive method, and using a frog, you're using a single column, and you're just getting it using the retention time. And if there is no confusion about what you're looking at, then maybe quite appropriate to to do some, monitoring with that. But you know, like that, if you have other components that may interfere with that, then you don't have the spectrum to check against. Okay.
Okay. Some more technical questions here. What type of Teflon tubing do you use as an extension for the triple quad?
We use something that we got from Zeus. I believe it was from Zeus. And we check that when we get it to make sure that we're not going to see anything that will be interfering with what we're having. Also, with all of our work, we do a transport efficiency. In other words, we introduce at the beginning and at the end of our hose to ensure that what we put in, we are getting back out. And I don't know the exact manufacturer.
Now, what if you come across commingled chlorinated contaminants? Let's say they're commingled with mercury. Have you come across anything like that? Does that shut you down, or how do you handle that?
Well, you know, we're often in situations where we have many other compounds, you know, like that, but these are the ones that are the drivers, you know, like that. Like when we were looking at the gasoline spill or somebody has gasoline in their homes, there's hundreds, if not thousands, of different compounds that make up gasoline. So that does not affect us, you know, like that, because we are checking it with, you know, like spikes along the way before and end. If we think that there is an issue like what we had in the beginning, we will get a difference of readings, you know, like that, contributions of different compounds, and then you would take, you would have to evaluate the data from there.
Okay. Let's see. Then how do you factor in barometric pressure or any ambient concentrations? Do you do some sort of correlation when you're first setting up?
Well, like I said, you know, like that, we calibrate in the airstream that we're going to be monitoring. So as if we're, you know, like that in New York and it's you know, like winter time and there's a snowstorm, we'll be monitoring at that reduced barometric pressure. And we'll be monitoring at the same pressure that we have been calibrating at. So it takes that into consideration right there.
Great. Now, what's your take on continuous vapor monitoring systems? And do you think these are going to become a primary method for vapor intrusion determination?
I think that, you know, like that, they offer information. You'd have to look at how much it costs. There's a cost element to it. There is a if you're going to do it for human health effects, then how good is your data quality? You're going to have to challenge it, so you know what your data quality is, and if it's going to be running unmanned, which, you know, like that, I would assume, is that how does this all get worked into the system to ensure that you're going to have high data quality, that if you're going to transport it over a distance, how do you determine your transport efficiency if it's going from a room to room? Because obviously, if that room has something in it, you have to know what you're doing or put it in a different compound. It'll be interesting to see what they develop for that, because right now I have those issues with it.
Okay. Thanks. Now, so how do you handle the risk of long-term temporal variability? Let's say if VI isn't occurring on the day you happen to go to the house. Do you sample at certain times of the year, or what do you do?
The We do sample different times of the year. We've done, you know, like multiple years, you know, like that. As far as the temporal, I've seen a number of papers on that, and I've looked at the radon papers as well, and you do see, you know, like differences with the time of day. But, you know, like that, I think that that is one of the things that would be interesting to do with this particular instrument is look at it at different times of the day when you see, when you would assume that there would be differences. But then again, one of the points that, and risk assessors will have to answer this, I guess, you know, like that, is that what difference does a 24-hour sample make over a one-minute sample if they're within 30%? When you're considering, you know, like a 70-year lifespan or a situation along those lines. So, you know, like that, you know, like that, you can look at the changes within a day. You can change, look at a change within a, you know, like a minute. You can change within a month. What exactly is there, you know, like that, are they concerned with if, are they going to accept as within their control charts?
Okay. All right. Now we have a question specific to the site you showed near the end in the saddle. How do you measure the contamination in groundwater, or did you measure the air around the surface water?
We just were measuring the air along the pathway, but it happened to be coincidental with when we crossed over the water. So, you know, like that, and every place that we saw open water, we saw that as well. So that's how the correlation to that the groundwater had reached surface water was at that particular location, because the actual stream is towards the bottom of the hill where the plant was at the top of the hill. So the groundwater is actually, you know, like that, more is closer to the surface there. I guess that's the best way to put it.
Okay. Another compound-specific question. Can TAGA be used for chloroprene in ambient air to help determine the source of fugitive emissions from indoor to outdoor in an industrial facility?
We actually were asked to look at that specifically, but we never went to the particular site. But yes, we were looking at chloroprene and 1,3-butadiene for looking at emissions off of sites.
Okay. Now, do you use any kind of compensation for humidity to increase ionization of some compounds?
No, not with this system, because with us, we just use ambient air. So it's the same matrix that we're sampling in, the same matrix that we're analyzing in.
Okay. And have you ever been in a situation where you would check your TAGA results along with, let's say, duplicate soil vapor samples to canisters from the same vapor pin? And let's see, I'm not sure if I'm asking this correctly.
We actually just did that where they wanted to know if we took Tedlar bags and where they took Summa canisters and whether or not they agree. And we have done that on some very large facilities, and they show good agreement.
Okay. And you haven't run across the situation where you had different results like that?
They're not identical. But then again, you know, like that, if they're within, you know, like that 25 or 30%, you know, like that's particularly at very high levels, because, again, if I'm looking at, you know, like 100 parts per million, and you have to start diluting your Summa canisters at 20 parts per billion, you know, let's use it 200 parts per million, so it's easy math for me. As, you know, like that, you're going to have to dilute that, you know, like that, 10,000 times. So instead of actually putting on, you know, like a, you know, like that 1 liter onto the sample, you'd be putting on 0.5 milliliters onto the your column, which is your accuracy to lay that low of a level onto your GC column. Is that reasonable? So otherwise you have to make outside dilutions. And you know, like there with me at 200, I would have to make a, you know, like a 100-to-1 dilution to get that. So what we find with our Summa canisters and Tedlar bags is that they show good agreement until you get, you know, like that at higher levels. And we find out that the Summa canister data varies, you know, like that by our tag of data, or excuse me, Tedlar bag data varies. However you want to describe it.
Okay. All right. Let's see. There's one more question where they're asking: in the case you saw where two of the ion transitions looked like TCE, but the third didn't, did you determine what the interference compound was?
No, because we actually took a Summa canister at this particular site on indoor air, because again the tag was used as a screening tool for this. And I had to take that and run it for, we were going to run it for selective TO15 for just the target compound. We then said, okay, for all of TO15, and then there was nothing in there as far as that compound. Then we said, okay, run it for, you know, like that, everything that could be available through a library search. Nothing came up with that either. And what we believe it is some sort of a oxygenated compound that did not come back out of the Summa canister nicely, and that's why you can see that on that particular slide that it cannot be polychlorinated because there is no 132.97, because that ion, you know, like that would be the loss of a chlorine 35. You have a loss of a chlorine 35 with when it's 130, when all the chlorines are 35. You have a loss of a chlorine 37 because there's only one chlorine on this. Well, trichloroethylene has three chlorines on it, so it cannot be that particular compound. So it has that molecular weight, but it does not have multiple chlorines on it.
Okay. All right. I think we're about to wind down here, but I do have one big question that multiple people have asked. We've got state folks and EPA folks that are asking, how do I get the TAGA Mobile Lab on my site? So can you talk a little bit about how these services are available, to whom, and who they should contact?
Well, for the EPA folks, you know, like that, the federal EPA folks, you know, like that, they can talk directly to me, and we can, you know, like discuss, you know, like what's needed for that. For the state folks, if they contact their EPA, OSC or RPM, we can work through the regional OSC to help them with their site. And, you know, like that, get the tag out there. I don't know if that helps out, but, you know, like that, that's the procedure that I would suggest.
Great. Okay. I've got one more question just came in. We mentioned the HAP site earlier, and this participant is asking if you could talk a little bit about the HAP site versus the TAGA and what you see as the limitations for the HAP site.
Okay, the HAP site is a, are you using it in the survey mode? Ask them, could you, they tell me if it's in the survey mode or if it's in the GCNS mode.
Both.
Oh, no, I'm sorry.
They said, I guess they're trying both.
All right, then let's discuss both of them. I'll do the survey mode first. Your survey mode, that you're going to be getting increased you'll get rapid analysis. So it streams across a membrane. That membrane can either is relatively selective. So your compounds can go across there, like that, without being absorbed onto the membrane or having some memory effect on the membrane. So that's one of the problems. You also, since you're not doing any pre-concentration, you may actually may be about a, you know, like 100 to 1,000 times above my detection limit. So I don't know what your detection limit is, and that's compound by compound for this. So that's one of the issues. Thirdly, you're a single quad. So you're only going to get the on this, you'll look at the 132, you'll look at the 130. You will not get the daughters. You'll not get the 95s or the 97s. So this particular, if you're using the 132 and the 130 to do your quantitation, you guys would have been confused with this, and you would have gotten a false reading. And I've seen that happen before. If you use the GCMS mode, then you'll have a retention time as well. So that will, if the TCE does not show up at your retention time, then you can say, no, it isn't. But you're not in a survey mode, so you have to collect a sample, you know, like that, and then so there's a concentration step, and then you shoot it across your membrane, and you know, like that, whether or not there's absorbance there, and then analyze it, you know, like that. But it has to go through a GC column. If I remember correctly how the HAP sites work, if I'm misstating anything, please let me know. So it's either selectivity, sensitivity, or real-time scanning.
Got it. Thank you. All right. Let's see. Thanks. Okay, one last question, and I think I might even know the answer to this one. How many TAGA units are available across the U.S.?
There are three different locations, and the one in Las Vegas has a TAGA unit in it. There's one in down here in RTP, we have a TAGA unit, and there's one in Edison, New Jersey, and it has a TAGA unit in it as well.
Right, I knew the answer. Yes. All right. Okay. One more question. Do you average your results based on criteria for each compound?
What we do is we look at the ions, and we will average them together if they're not interfered with. If like on this one where we are looking at the TCE and we do not see the blue line, which is associated with one of the ions that we're available with or that we're using to quantitate it with, this is a non-detect. So we don't just average it together and give you a number. We will take, when we say we do two compounds, six ions in a room, we will take 60 readings because that's about how long it takes to collect about a minute's worth of data, and we'll average those as we go from room to room to room. And that's how we do that.
Great. Thank you, Dave. I think we've made it through all of the questions. So at this time, I want to thank you again for the presentation, and we're just going to go through some closing reminders real quick for folks who need some credit for watching this or anything else. Let's see. So first I want to ask you all to stay connected by signing up for our free monthly newsletter called Tech Direct. Here you can learn about new webinars and resources related to hazardous waste site cleanup. I want to thank you again for joining today's live webinar. I'd like to remind you that slides and other items related to this session can be found on the seminar resources page. And this is going to stay with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentation. You'll also find information for our speakers and organizers on the presenters page, as we noted earlier. I'd like to ask that you take a brief moment to fill out the online feedback form and let us know what you thought of today's session, both of the content covered and the method of delivery. This feedback form is required in order to obtain a seminar participation certificate. We don't issue PDHs or CEUs for our webinars, but you may save or print a webinar participation certificate after you submit the feedback form for today's event. Be sure to check the box at the bottom of the feedback form to certify that you were here for the entire event, or that you've replayed the complete archive. If you do not check the box, you will not receive a certificate. You may find that a copy of your registration email, the seminar slides, and the feedback confirmation email are enough to document your participation in today's event with your own accrediting institution for PDHs or CEUs. If you participated as a group, each person can fill out that online feedback form to get their own certificate. This applies to those watching the recorded version of this session as well. We do look at your comments as we continue to try to improve the content and delivery mechanisms. You can also request a confirmation email from the feedback page as a record of your participation in today's event. If you require further assistance, please feel free to contact Jean Balance at balance.jean@epa.gov. Lastly, today's session was recorded. In the near future, you'll be able to access the slides and hear the presentation as it was given today as part of the archive. This will be available in approximately 2 weeks. You'll receive an automatic email once that archive is available. That's the end of our final reminders. Thank you for joining today's session. I hope you found it to be a valuable use of your time, and we will see you on a future webinar. This is the formal conclusion of today's broadcast.